Hey everyone, Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Thank you for joining me. In this episode, we're going to go through part two of my personal investing framework. Now, if you haven't already listened to part one, I definitely recommend going and checking that out first. That covers all sorts of topics to do with investing, starting right out at what is an investment in the first place, sort of giving you my technical definition. Then going through margin of safety, investing in 50 cent dollars versus growing businesses, the four M's from Phil Town, and a whole bunch of good stuff kind of in that episode. So if you haven't heard that, definitely go and check that out first before you listen to this one. But in this episode, we're going to cover a few more topics to do with my sort of general investing framework, what I'm looking for, and kind of my style of investing. So we're going to talk about sourcing ideas, how I come up with stocks to look into in the first place. Is it just random, or am I getting them from somewhere semi-intelligent? We're also going to talk about cash allocations, what percentage of my portfolio sits in cash at any one time, and how do I sort of think about that? I was going to talk a little bit about patience and aggression with investing, talk a little bit about personal finance in terms of sort of saving money in the first place to put into the market. And then we're also going to touch a little bit on sort of my ongoing process of continuing to try and learn and become a better investor and, you know, share those ideas with other people. So with all that said, let's get straight into the episode, and I hope you enjoy. So let's jump straight into it with sourcing ideas. Now, there are thousands of public companies around the world, thousands of stocks, and unfortunately, we can't do a deep dive into all of them. We simply don't have the time or mental capacity probably to do that. So we need to do something a little bit more intelligent to try and narrow down the universe of stocks to look into. So I have sort of three main ways that I find stock ideas to look at. The first one, and if I just look kind of historically at my portfolio over the past couple of years, certainly the most common one in terms of finding an idea and then it eventually ending up in my portfolio is going through the 13F filings. Now, if you're not familiar with a 13F, basically this is a quarterly filing that large investors in the US have to make each quarter. And basically it tells us all of the stocks that they own. And we can then use, you know, websites that sort of collect this data and go back and compare it against what they owned in previous quarters and so on to basically see whether these investors are holding or buying or selling out of this various range of companies. So that's a really kind of fertile hunting ground for me. If there's a stock in the portfolio of Warren Buffett or Monish Pabrai or Charlie Munger or any of these investors that have fairly similar strategies to me and that I kind of like and respect, it's gone through a lot of filters to get there. It's passed a lot of tests to get there. And they're sort of, I guess, like my unpaid analysts in some way. They go out, find good ideas, put them in their own portfolios, and then I can see them, you know, on that 90-day delay with the 13Fs, and I can start to dig into them. So historically speaking, 13Fs have been a really good source for me. A couple of simple ways to find them is simply just to Google, you know, an investor name or their fund name and then 13F. So, for example, if you want to look at Warren Buffett's 13F, you can Google Warren Buffett 13F or Berkshire Hathaway 13F, which is Warren Buffett's company. And that will show you his portfolio and show you the moves he's been making recently. So, as I say, that's been a really fertile hunting ground. On YouTube, I try to do a video every quarter on the 13Fs. So I'll go through and, you know, look at some of my favorite investors and what they've been buying and selling and kind of do a summary of that. But a few that I really like to look at kind of every single quarter, Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway are definitely top of the list. I'm also looking at the Daily Journal Corporation, which has a portfolio managed by Charlie Munger. I'm also looking at Monish Pabrai at Pabrai Funds. I'm looking at Guy Spier with the Aquamarine Fund. Who else am I looking at? I'm looking at Li Lu at Himalaya Capital, and I also have a few other investors that I sort of look at every now and then. So the likes of Seth Klarman or Bill Ackman or Norbert Liu is one I've recently come across as well. So that hopefully gives you a few sort of ideas, a few starting points to try and look into. So that's the first way that I'm generally sourcing ideas, but there's a couple of other ways that I'm doing it as well. So the second one, frankly, is just everyday life. Like many of you, I'm sure, interact with a lot of products and a lot of different companies really on a daily basis. And those are businesses that I'm quite likely to understand very well. I'm currently recording this into a Rode microphone and I'm using an HP laptop. I've got some Sony headphones. I'm reading notes off an Apple iPhone. And those are a lot of brands that, you know, I'm going to understand the business models of those companies, you know, relatively easily. I don't know if Rode is a public company, but I know that HP is a public company. I'm pretty sure Sony is, but I would have to check. And Apple is a public company clearly as well. So right there, I've got a whole bunch of companies that I can understand probably quite simply, quite easily, quite quickly. And it gives me the ability to sort of build a watch list around that. So simply everyday life for most people is a really good starting point to find different companies. You know, other things that I've dug into, done deep dives on and put on the watch list would be things like Monster Beverage, would be things like McDonald's or Domino's Pizza. If you eat a bit of fast food every now and then, those might be businesses you want to have a look into. And these aren't stock tips or anything, but, you know, this is just kind of an example of how I tend to find some of these companies. So everyday life is the second one. And the third way that I'm generally sourcing ideas is one that I'm quite privileged to have. And that is basically from the people listening to this podcast or the people that watch my YouTube channel, the subscribers. Now, I sort of cloned a brilliant idea from Monish Prabhai, which is to source good ideas from other people, try and get ideas that, again, have passed through a lot of filters and passed a lot of tests already, rather than just simply starting with the A's and trying to go through to Z in terms of every company out there. So I put my email address out there on a recent YouTube video, investingwithtom@gmail.com, if you want to contact me in any way. And I got a whole bunch of stock ideas from that, and I've now got about probably 10 to 15 companies to look into out of that. So those are some of the ways that I tend to source ideas. I try to interact as much as I can with other smart people. Unfortunately, I can't get on the phone to some of these famous investors, but 13Fs are sort of the next best thing, I suppose. I can get some ideas from everyday life, and then I'm lucky enough to get some ideas from the people that support this podcast and the YouTube channel. So that's generally how I'm sort of building a watch list. Basically, my process from there usually is trying to first understand the business and basically walk through sort of Phil Town's checklist, understand the business, understand the management team, what competitive advantages that business may or may not have over their competitors. And then from there, try and figure out what the company is worth. We know that no company is worth an infinite price. So from there, it sort of goes on a watch list. If it's at a reasonable price, I will buy it. I will buy shares in the company. If it's not, but I think I, you know, really understand the business quite well, I like what they're doing, that's when it goes on a watch list. And I have sort of a target price that if it starts to get to that point, I will start to purchase into the company. So that's basically the way that I approach it. So that's sourcing ideas. Let's move on to cash. Now, this is an interesting topic. So we sort of have a mix of opinions from a lot of different investors on the topic of cash. So some investors will tend to be fully invested all the time. So Peter Lynch, that managed Fidelity Magellan, was a great example of that. I know Guy Spier is also pretty close, at least, to fully invested most of the time. Basically, these are all investors that know that over the very long term, the stock market tends to go up. So in general, you want to have as much money as possible invested as opposed to sitting on the sidelines in cash. Cash isn't typically earning much for you, particularly today when interest rates are very, very low. And in sort of real terms and in terms of the purchasing power of those dollars, you're actually going backwards. If you're earning only, say, 1% interest on cash in a bank account or in a term deposit or a bond or whatever it might be, and inflation is, say, 2% a year, then you're suddenly, you know, going back by 1% a year. You're going backwards in terms of being able to purchase goods and services and so on. So cash is probably not the ideal place to have money long term. It's probably one of the worst places to have money long term. But there are some advantages to having a bit of money on the sidelines in cash. particularly when we get to sort of panicked situations in the stock market. So for that reason, I do tend to keep some of the portfolio in cash. Again, I tend to sort of navigate towards more of the Warren Buffett strategy on this one, where he does keep a substantial amount of money in cash from time to time. And it means that in market crashes and market panics, he's able to deploy a lot of that capital, a lot of that money, and acquire ownership in businesses at far more attractive prices than he might have otherwise been able to if he'd been fully invested and not kind of had that dry powder ready to go. So again, I really like to pull good ideas from other people. So basically, in terms of cash allocation, a few years ago, Monish Prabhai, again, one of my favorite investors, laid out this framework of how he thinks about managing cash. And I've basically just copied it. So I'll share that with you today. So essentially, the framework basically goes like this. So you start out with 100% cash, for example, if you've never invested before. And again, none of this financial advice, but this is kind of the way I approach it. You start out with 100% cash, and then you look at a wide range of opportunity sets. So, or a wide range of opportunities. So you're looking at all the companies you can understand and you can value and all the other things that we talk about. And then essentially you're trying to figure out, you know, what sort of return can you get out of these different opportunities? And in the case of Monish Prabhai, he's willing to invest up to 75% of his portfolio. So he takes, you know, out of that chunk of all his money that he has currently sitting on the sidelines, hypothetically, if he were to be starting from scratch today, if he can find businesses that he thinks are trading at, say, 50% of intrinsic value, or that he thinks will double in the next 3 to 5 years, that is, those are the types of opportunities where he will put up to about 75% of his cash to work. So if you can find, say, a range of opportunities where you think the stock will double in the next 3 to 5 years, and we're not probably talking about just one stock here, we're probably talking about a group of stocks. But if you can find doubles, he will invest up to about 75% of the portfolio. And again, that's something that I've kind of copied. So that leaves you with now only 25% cash, assuming that you've found some opportunities that you think will double in the next 3 to 5 years. So after that, we have sort of another threshold. So Prabhai will invest an additional 10%. So he's got 75 initially plus another 10 now. So he's now 85% invested. If he can find, as well as those businesses that sort of sucked up the 75%, if he can find companies that will triple, or in this case, probably just one company that he thinks will triple because it's only a 10% position, which Prabhai tends to run pretty concentrated and so do I. So 10% is probably just one stock for the both of us at this point. Again, not financial advice, but that's basically the next threshold. So we've got 75% in doubles. We've got the next 10% in triples. We've got the next 10%. So this is now taking us up to 95% invested in 4Xs. So businesses that we think can quadruple over the next 3 to 5 years. And then the final 5% of the portfolio that would otherwise be sitting in cash is what Prabhai calls very expensive capital. And this basically says that, you know, every now and again, we have big dislocations and mispricings in markets. And having cash at those times is extremely beneficial. So in order to put that last final sort of 5% of cash to work, it needs to be at least a 5X in 3 to 5 years. So it's very expensive capital, as Prabhai puts it. In order to put that cash to work, the opportunity has to be spectacular. And that basically means that we're really never fully invested at times when the market is at all-time highs and we can't really find much. But we do tend to get fully invested when markets are crashing and, you know, things look kind of ugly. So that's a cash framework that I've adopted, and it's working really well. It's something that I struggled with for quite some time in order to get a nice kind of framework around how to manage that and be a little bit more quantitative with, you know, what I'm doing in that position for my portfolio. But that's a really nice framework that I quite like, and it's been working well for me so far. So that's how I'm talking about, or that's how I'm managing cash. And the final sort of thing on the direct kind of investment side is more of kind of a personality trait, or a mental thing rather than a pure quantitative or, you know, thing that I'm looking for in a particular investment. And it's basically having this kind of, or at least striving to have this unusual combination of patience and decisiveness or aggression. And basically what I'm getting at here is that really good investment opportunities are not common. You're not going to find them every day or every week or every month or maybe even every year. You know, a lot of investors, I'm reading through some of the old Warren Buffett letters at the moment, and I'm reading some of his letters from the 80s where, you know, he hadn't had a good stock idea for 2 years. And he was patient enough to sort of hold off continuing to have his existing positions generate cash for him that he could then kind of stock up on the sidelines, pile up on the sidelines where he couldn't find these, when he couldn't find these doubles or triples, you know, as Prabhu might talk about. And then a couple of years later, when an opportunity to purchase into Coca-Cola did present itself, he was extremely decisive and aggressive with piling a lot of money into that particular investment. And that's the way that Buffett has always approached it. He's been extremely patient for long stretches of time when he can't find anything that's of particular interest. But when a, you know, perfect pitch, as he'd describe it, does present itself, he's got the ability to put a lot of capital to work really, really quickly. So that's something I just thought I'd mentioned. Investing is a game that requires a lot of patience if you're going to do it well. But you've also got to be in the mindset that, you know, even though you may have spent months or years even potentially accumulating a cash position from your job and all that sort of stuff, if the right opportunity does come along, you have to be in a mindset where you can deploy a lot of that cash very quickly. So that's kind of what I try to strive for in my own investing as well. All right. So that brings us to personal finance and kind of my ongoing process. So that hopefully gives you a pretty nice overview of my sort of overall investing framework. We've covered a fair bit of ground there. So I really hope that clarifies things in terms of what I'm looking for, and you can maybe relate to that or not, depending on your investing strategy. Again, it's all about trying to learn from different people and figure out what works for you, but that's kind of what I think works for me. So that is some general topics on my investing framework. So on the personal finance side, I just want to talk very briefly about trying to save money. You know, not all of us are in the position where we have bucket loads of cash coming in all the time without much effort, and we can just invest, you know, as much as we reasonably want to. And we're not in the position of Warren Buffett, for example, where he owns all these businesses that throw cash at him every single year that he's kind of struggling to deploy. Most of us are working everyday jobs and, you know, trying to pay the bills and everything first, and then, you know, whatever might be left over, often people are looking to do something with. Maybe it's investing, maybe some people just spend on having fun, I don't quite know. But, you know, not everyone's in a position to have bucket loads of cash to just deploy willy-nilly. So here are a few tips that I've kind of used to try and get more money to invest, try and get the snowball started early and get it started aggressively to try and grow a nest egg, you know, as young as I can and as large as I can, hopefully over the long term as well. So here are some very basic concepts. I'm going to say something right now that is going to sound extremely obvious, but it really is a non-negotiable and something that you can't fudge. And that is, in order to save money, you have to spend less than you earn. And although that sounds extremely basic, I don't think a lot of people have that particularly clear in their heads sometimes. So I'm going to give you some very basic personal finance tips here. Basically, the way that I manage my life when I get some income coming into me is I essentially have three bank accounts. Now, this may get more complicated over time depending on your situation. Maybe you have business accounts and you have different brokerage accounts because you're investing in the US and New Zealand and Australia and, you know, wherever else. But the fundamental kind of idea here is that I have basically one account, which is where all the money flows into whenever I get paid. And that sort of also acts as kind of my everyday account. So I have like my FPOS card and, you know, debit card and so on kind of linked to that particular account. But this is sort of the process that I go through. So the first account is where all the money flows into, and it's where I spend my money from. So that might not sound that clean and tidy because, you know, if all the money flows into that one account and I've got the ability to spend from that account, maybe I'm just going to spend it all. But I've got a couple of other accounts set up in a way that, you know, stops me from doing that. So this is what I've got. So the first account is where all the money hits. The second account that I've got is basically an emergency fund. And this is super old school, really boring stuff, but you need an emergency fund. If the last year or so has taught us anything, it's that anything can happen. And you need to have some money on the side should you need it. Should you lose your job or should you have some major expense come up? And there's different sort of guidelines that people will use around emergency funds. Maybe it's 3 months expenses, maybe it's 6 months expenses. It might be more or less depending on whether you have kids or whether you own a house or, you know, what kind of your setup in life is. For me, it's a little bit on the lighter side. I don't have kids. I don't own a house. I live fairly frugally and I don't have a lot of sort of random expenses tend to come up. I don't even own a car right now. I have like a company vehicle as well. So for me, I have a relatively small emergency fund, but that is the second account that I've got. So basically what I do is I fill that up to whatever my goal is for an emergency fund on the side. If I ever need to spend some of that money on a genuine emergency, and again, that is only for genuine emergencies. It's not to go out to the pub on the weekend. Then that will automatically be the bank account that sort of gets refilled straight away the next time I get paid. That will become the priority. But generally speaking, that gets filled up. It kind of sits there on the side and then hopefully I never need that money that's in the emergency fund. And anything else goes to the third bank account, which is sort of my long-term savings. Now, I use a third bank account and long-term savings as kind of a bit of a simplification here. This may include a whole range of different brokerage accounts, like I mentioned earlier, just depending on what I might be investing in at the time. But fundamentally, we should have a third account, which is purely for savings. And any money that ever enters that third account will never leave that account under any circumstances whatsoever, unless it's getting invested, whether it's buying a house or buying into shares or, you know, something along those lines. So there I have it. Basically, I have three accounts, and whenever money hits my bank account, this is the way that I sort of manage that. So let's first assume that the emergency fund is fully stocked. If it's not, then anytime that money hits my bank account, I would have set my first bank account. I would essentially figure out, you know, how much money do I think I can save consistently every week or fortnight or month or however frequently you get paid. And then as soon as that money hits your first kind of everyday account when you get paid, it's immediately funneled off to that emergency fund to fill it up. And I have quite structured numbers here. So every single fortnight for me, which is the frequency that I get paid at, the same amount of money leaves that account pretty much, you know, instantly as soon as I get paid. And I'm essentially left with a little bit of money kind of left over in that everyday account to pay the bills, to enjoy myself a little bit and have some spending money. But by and large, I've got a very large chunk of that money just been funneled into firstly an emergency fund, but assuming that's already full, going straight into my long-term savings and kind of investing accounts. So it's the oldest trick in the book. It's pay yourself first. It's identify an amount that you can save consistently every single pay. And basically, as soon as I get paid, it just gets funneled into the long-term savings account, assuming the emergency fund is stocked. So those are some very basic tips. I basically, like I say, have those three bank accounts, and that's sort of the way that I manage it. There are some advantages to that. The first book on money I ever read was Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki, which I'm sure many of the people listening have probably read. But one of the tips in there is to pay yourself first, and that's exactly what I'm describing. So what a lot of people do that maybe aren't so financially literate or, you know, whatever you want to call it, often what those people do is they'll have maybe one bank account or whatever, and they will get paid. They'll then go out and pay their bills. They'll spend their money on, you know, going to the pub or getting food or whatever they want to spend their money on. And then maybe if there's something left, then they'll save it. Now, paying yourself first is the idea of kind of flipping that around the other way. So instead of spending a bunch of money and then saving what's left, Basically, you save a bunch of money and then you've got a bit left over to spend. So it means that you can become much more consistent with the amounts that you're saving every time you get paid. And it sounds really basic, and I know it's a super old idea that I'm sure many of you have heard 100 times, but it does genuinely work. So that's a couple of tips just on kind of saving money. The other thing I would say is sort of around your income and expenses in general. So there's a lot of personal finance people out there that will tell you that, you know, you need to be extremely frugal and reduce your expenses as much as you possibly can. And I think for a lot of people, that tends to be true. I'm 26 years old as I'm recording this podcast, and I live pretty cheaply. I live in a very small one bedroom kind of unit with my girlfriend, and sort of living like a student in a lot of ways. I left university about 4 years ago, but still trying to live very, very cheaply. And it's been great. I've saved a bucket load of money by, I think, probably the average 26-year-old standards over the past few years. And I hope to continue kind of doing that. So certainly getting your expenses down will help. Saving money on, you know, not going to the Starbucks of the world or whatever it is for you, and spending $5 a day on a coffee or an energy drink will certainly help. But I tend to be one that likes to focus on the big stuff. You know, you can save a few dollars here and there by not going out and getting those drinks that are going to disappear 10 minutes later and you'll never get your money back from. But I tend to like to focus on the really big stuff. So housing, transportation, going on fancy holidays. These are often the areas where really large amounts of money get spent and can potentially be saved. So for me, it's been living in a small one-bedroom unit. It's been holidaying locally, which, you know, pretty much everyone has to do at the moment. And it's been trying to get my, you know, vehicle expenses down as low as possible. So those are a few tips. The only thing I would say there is a limit to how low you can get your expenses. Obviously, you can't live on $0. So at some point, if you want to kind of level up a little bit in terms of trying to save more money and have more cash available to invest, it's really about trying to get your income up in some way. So I know there's lots of ways to you can go about doing this. I'll talk you through what I've done and what I'm still trying to do right now. Excuse me. So basically what I've done is I work an everyday job. I'm on a salary. I do have a degree, so My salary is good, but it's nothing crazy at all. It's under six figures, definitely. So, you know, I work an everyday job. I get paid a regular salary from that. And that has sort of steadily gone up over time, which has been great as I've become more experienced and so on. But it's really not massively scalable. You know, I work a 40-hour week. If I wanted to triple my salary, you know, I could perhaps work 3 times the hours and run myself completely into the ground and have absolutely no life. But there is kind of, you know, there's a ceiling to how high that can go. Even if I do become more qualified or more experienced or get into, you know, bigger and better companies or whatever it might be, there is a ceiling on how high that number can get from transactions where you're basically sacrificing your time to do work in order to receive money, things that are on an hourly basis. So that can only go so far. So that kind of leads me to some of the other things I'm doing now. Some of the things like YouTube, like starting this podcast, which currently earns $0, but you never know, one day it might do something. Because those things are far more scalable. So it allows me to add value to other people. You know, I really like and I really enjoy doing this in the first place, but it also allows me to teach others and interact with others and so on. But in terms of generating income, it's extremely scalable. So, you know, I spent the first, I believe it was around 14 months creating YouTube videos very consistently, and I earned $0. Now, in the next sort of 12 months after that, I've probably earned about $12,000 to $14,000 from YouTube by putting in probably a similar amount of effort. And This year, I'm going to put in probably a similar amount of effort again, and I'm probably going to earn a whole lot more than $12,000 to $14,000. And I hope that the year after that, again, I'll put a similar amount of effort in and I'll earn a bunch more. And although, you know, $10,000 to $12,000 is a really nice amount of money to have coming in on the side for a lot of people, it's not life-changing, but it is scalable. So something that gets me really excited about YouTube and working online from an income perspective is that I can consistently chip away at it. And over time, I'm building up sort of this library of content that continues to get views and continues to generate a small amount of income from each of those older videos. I'm growing an audience and it's sort of just snowballing up over time, which is fantastic, just like we want to do in our investments. So if you're interested in starting some sort of side hustle or some sort of business of your own, I think that's a great thing to do. It will certainly take some perseverance and some hard kind of slogging and groundwork to get off the ground. But there's two tips I would give. The first one is find something scalable. Try to avoid things where you trade your time for money and you're kind of restricted by what an hourly rate might be, or you're restricted by the number of hours that you might put into that particular job. Try and get away from things that are directly tied to the hours that you put into that particular venture. And also just try to add value to people and be unique in some way. There's a lot of people out there that try to copy other businesses and go into businesses where there's a bunch of different competition. Maybe it's like lawn mowing or something. I don't know. Lawn mowing or e-commerce or, you know, there's a lot of things like that that are very competitive now. So try to do something kind of unique. Try to add value to other people and try to make it scalable. So that was a bit of a side rant, but that's kind of my other personal finance tip. There's only so much you can drop your expenses. So in order to get your savings rate really, really high and try and propel yourself forward a bit more, it does at some point, unfortunately, as difficult as it is and can be, it does at some point come down to trying to generate a bit more income for yourself as well. All right. So final thing I'm going to touch on is just a few tips on sort of my ongoing investment process. So we've talked about what I'm looking for in an investment. We're talking about where do I try and find these ideas. We've talked about, again, a bit of personal finance stuff. But really, there's a lot that we just need to keep on top of. You know, the best investors often are the ones that turn over the most stones, that look into the most companies and so on. So in order to try and do that and become one of those people that is, you know, really successful in the stock market, there's a few things that I do. And this isn't a particularly long list, but hopefully it gives you a feel for kind of what I'm trying to do. So the first one is a tip from Charlie Munger that has stuck with me for the past 2 or 3 years, and I'm sure will stick with me for much longer. And that is to go to bed a little bit wiser than you were when you woke up. And that sounds very basic. And it is pretty simple to achieve. You know, even something like reading for 10 or 15 minutes before you go to bed, or watching a YouTube video on, you know, some sort of topic that interests you, or listening to a podcast, or, you know, scrolling through what some intelligent people are saying on Twitter or whatever it might be. Any of those sorts of things are going to make you hopefully a little bit wiser, help you to learn something. And over time, if you can do these little things consistently, it does genuinely grow and sort of compound in terms of your knowledge. You start to build up what Charlie Munger would call mental models, and you try to, you know, you can start to connect those mental models, and I believe he calls it a lattice work of mental models. You can start to learn all these different things in different parts of the world and try and kind of tie them together. And over time, you start to understand a little bit more about how the world works. And then when you're practically sort of looking into companies, you can often tie things together and pick up various mental models and lessons from the past, and more quickly process what that company's trying to do and come to a pretty accurate opinion on, you know, the future of the business, whether it's undervalued or overvalued and all that sort of stuff. So go to bed a little bit wiser than you were when you woke up. A few things that I'm also doing. So I try to read a reasonable amount. It's something I've been a little slack with over the past year, but The goal for 2021 is to read 10 books. So that's a goal that I've set for myself this year. I listen to a bucket load of podcasts, and that's sort of one of the reasons that I've started this podcast is because I really like them. So I assume other people do as well. So I learn lots from podcasts. I've watched all of the Berkshire Hathaway meetings. So if you go back, I think as far as 1994 through to basically 2021 meetings coming up soon. You can watch all the old Berkshire Hathaway meetings. I know Monash Prabhai listens to these in the shower every morning. So there's a whole bunch of nuggets of wisdom in those meetings. So that's a resource I always find myself coming back to, and they're just available for free on YouTube. Just simply search Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting 1994 or 2000 or whatever year you're looking at. Go back and start with the earliest one you can find and just kind of work your way forward there. Pretty easy to listen to. Also pretty entertaining. Actually, those guys are quite funny as well. So the Berkshire Hathaway meetings, I've recently gotten more into FinTwit, into the finance world on Twitter. So if you're interested in following me there, I'm at TomInvesting, I believe, on Twitter. So trying to post more there. There's lots of smart people on Twitter as well. So certainly check that out. And a couple of other kind of havens for value investors. So there's a forum called The Corner of Berkshire and Fairfax, which I really like. It's a pretty old school forum, but there's some very intelligent people on there talking about pretty much every stock you could ever imagine. And I believe that, so there is a paywall, but I believe it's something like $30 Canadian for a lifetime membership. And there's just massive value on there. Like, that's crazy good how smart some of the people are on there. So certainly check out Corner of Berkshire and Fairfax. You can also search those forums if you want to see what people are talking about with one specific stock or whatever it might be. And the final resource I have is Value Investors Club. So Value Investors Club is basically a place where investors can go to leave write-ups of their best stock ideas. And again, it's just a nice place to go. You can look up a particular ticker symbol for a stock. So if you want to look at Apple, for example, or Amazon or whatever it might be, and there's, again, a very large number of stocks on here, you can look that up and see all of the write-ups that have been done basically in the history of the Value Investors Club. You can see when they were written, whether they were a short thesis, you know, when they thought the stock was going to go down, or whether they were a regular sort of long thesis where they thought the stock was going to go up. You can kind of see how people's, theories have evolved over time, whether they've been right or wrong. And it's just a nice way to pick up, you know, ideas and, you know, angles on companies that you might not have thought of yourself. So those are a couple of the resources that I use that everyone can access. The only other thing I would say is just making YouTube videos and recording podcasts like this in general is actually a really nice way to keep myself accountable. So continuing to work on my process and all that sort of stuff. So if you're interested in starting a podcast or doing starting a YouTube channel, that is actually a very good way to learn more about investing yourself. So those are a few things for me, and that's really all I've got to talk about on this particular podcast. So I do hope you enjoyed the episode and both parts of this sort of investing framework podcast. We covered a lot of ground. So I really appreciate you spending your time listening to this firstly, and I do hope you got something out of it. But that's all from me today, and until next time.